Teresa Sullivan would have a memorable answer to the question, "What did you do this summer?" After a chaotic few months that saw her pushed from and reinstated to her job as president of the University of Virginia, Sullivan sat down on Monday with editors and reporters at Inside Higher Ed to discuss the state of the public research university, UVA's future, and how recent events have changed her own profile within higher education.
These are interesting times for public higher education, not just for you.
Right.
As you look at sort of the state of public research universities, in part through your experience of recent months, how are you feeling about sort of the state of the sector and what are its challenges?
Well, I think there are a lot of challenges. First of all, there's a lot of pressure on all the revenue sources. I would also say I don't think it's unique to the public institutions, but I do think that we're facing the problem in an accelerated form. Now, the first, of course, which everybody knows, is the decline in the state appropriations. And if you look at the state budgets these days, it's easy to see where that comes from. The second issue is the political pressure on rising tuition. And so increases in tuition are increasingly resisted by legislators and by governors. And so that's a break on another revenue source. When we come to the federal government, I don't even want to talk about sequestration. That would really be the worst possible. But even short of that, it seems likely that we will have at least stasis in the research funds, if not retrenchment there. I can't tell what's going to happen with federal financial aid, but that's another big issue. The Accountable Health Act is going to affect the reimbursement to our hospitals for Medicare and for possibly for GME. Those are big issues for us if you've got a hospital and a health system. So all that is out there, too. You know, I said that I don't exempt the privates from this. There are many privates who get tuition equalization grants or something equivalent, which will be under pressure. And, of course, the federal money affects the private institutions as well as public. But I think the public institutions are more on the in the bullseye right now than the privates are.
And so what's your path forward? You can't – everything – most of the problems you just identified – you can't fix. How do you see UVA's direction in responding to these things?
UVA is in the fortunate position that we have had pretty good success with philanthropy. And that will obviously be one of the things that we have to look at. We also, I think, as I think every institution does, need to look at what can produce meaningful cost savings. And by meaningful, I mean you do not cut your way to greatness, but there are some expenditures that you can prioritize and that are less important than others. So that's something I think we always have to look at and do that every year. I'm also interested in talking with our state about some of the ways that they make their investments. So, for example, I think it might be useful for the Commonwealth of Virginia to think about putting some of its financial aid money into work study. And the reason I say that is that all of us are quite strapped for staff. But work study can be a meaningful way in which a student can gain work experience, get references on the job, and learn something in our laboratories or in our libraries that can really be a useful and transferable skill, and at the same time stretch the scarce staff resources that we have available to us. But I think there are some things we can talk about there with our states that would be politically palatable.
What about changes in institutional behavior? I mean, you've actually, your last two institutions were actually kind of ahead of the game in some ways, not by their choice, but in terms of seeing state budgets cut. I mean, it's been a while since UVA had a significant portion of its funds provided by the state, so it's sort of gotten used to that. But how much activity do you see in the direction of of the privatization discussion and all that? I mean, where do you see that at UVA and nationally?
Well, let me talk about privatization first. When Thomas Jefferson founded the university, he did it with a mixture of public and private money. Virginia was not public because it was completely supported by the General Assembly. In fact, in the President's home at Carr's Hill is a handwritten letter by Thomas Jefferson complaining that the General Assembly doesn't provide enough money for the institution.
So it goes back a ways.
It does go back a ways. So you are not public or private because of where your dollars come from. The institutions we call private have plenty of public money going to them. The parents of the students get federal tax credits. Their contributions are tax deductible. And besides, there's research money and financial aid and so on going to those institutions too. So public and private is not a matter of dollars and cents. It is, to a large extent, a matter of mission. Will UVA continue to have a public mission? Yes, we will, even if we don't get a dollar of money from the General Assembly. Being public is the way that we were founded. Our intention is, and our founding purpose is, to serve the public, not just to the Commonwealth, but actually we now see it as serving beyond the boundaries of the Commonwealth as well. But does it mean that we will continue to get resources from perhaps novel sources, you know, look for other ways to underwrite our what we do? Yes. Will we look for ways to collaborate? Yes. So, you know, this year we will be offering 2 4-credit courses via telepresence with 3 other Virginia universities. And they similarly are going to offer courses that our students can take. That's a way for us to share our resources among these 4 public institutions. It makes a lot of sense. It lets us teach a specialized course that we might not have enough students for at the university and still share it with other students around the Commonwealth. We're going to look for more opportunities like that. I think we all have to do that.
Well, what about like the basic model? Darden was cited a lot when UCLA decided not that long ago that they were going to try to follow the same model. As you look at that, you know, which is seemingly a more dramatic shift, is that something you see more of?
Yes. Yeah, so what happens with Darden is that Darden is permitted to let its tuition rise to the market level. And in return, Darden foregoes a share of the state appropriations, though Darden does pay us an overhead cost every year, too. And the law school has a similar relationship. And notably, both Darden and law are very competitive nationally. To some extent, I think we're almost getting to that point with medical schools because so much of the funding of a medical school is not tuition. But I think the sticking point is the undergraduate programs. I think that it's politically much more difficult to say, let our undergraduate programs be self-sufficient. Because being self-sufficient would mean rising to market rate. There's a big difference right now between what a Virginia resident pays and what a non-resident pays.
I want to ask you just a little bit about your role now going ahead. When we were writing about the controversies of the summer, not only was there intense interest from UVA alumni and faculty or whatever, but like all of our readers couldn't get enough of the story. Have you thought about how you're out there speaking to various groups? Have you thought about how your role different now that you are the president who came back than it was before?
Yeah, there are things that are different about it. I am much more easily recognized. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not totally certain. I say the great advantage for UVA is that our alumni are so alert now, so interested. It's such a great opportunity to talk to them. But also our faculty. You know, our faculty have shown in every way possible that they're deeply concerned about the University of Virginia. And that's a great resource for a president to draw on, particularly in a day and age when it's very easy to be connected via telecommunication to your colleague in, Beijing instead of your colleague down the hall. So, those are great assets for us, and I intend to do what I can do with that. To some extent, I'm seen more as a spokesperson for the public sector of higher education. I don't think I can claim that mantle. Public higher education is a vast spectrum of institutions in very different kinds of situations. I can talk about some things that I think will work, But just because I think it works in Charlottesville doesn't mean it's going to work at somewhere else, even in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And so I don't want to put myself forward with an expertise I haven't earned.
Nina, one of the debates in higher ed, though, is how much, and this isn't just UVA, is, you know, is the sky falling? And we have the sort of disruption camp that is saying higher ed is going to look so different in just a few years. You're now tagged as the incrementalist. Do you feel that you're, are you a spokeswoman for being an incrementalist?
I think I should also be tagged as the demographer. There is a lot of underlying demography that affects American higher education, which we ignore at our peril. The number of 18-year-olds will decline every year going forward. Now, it's different in some states than others. Generally, the Sun Belt states have more 18-year-olds coming up, and in general, the industrialized Midwest does not. But that's an issue. We will be fighting for what is in the United States a shrinking pie. Now, on the other hand, if you look overseas, if you look at China, if you look at India, they have the opposite issue. They have a lot more 18-year-olds coming up every year, more than they have higher education resources for. The other thing in the United States is that we have a big baby boomer group approaching retirement and very worried about their own security at a time when we are less willing through taxes to give dollars to the public. And so the claimants on those dollars are going to be the next generation, K through 12 and higher ed, versus the retiring generation, which is very worried about health care and economic security. That demographic tension cannot be taken out of the equation if you want to talk about what's happening to higher education. So I actually see the issue in a bigger demographic frame than just what is or is not happening to higher education.
And so for UVA, which is a residential undergraduate experience for the undergrads in not the major population center of the state, as you look ahead, do you see UVA through Coursera or other ways consciously seeking more students who don't fit your traditional undergraduate demographic?
If we wanted more students in residence in Charlottesville, we can easily have them. We just have to push that yes button more often. We get lots and lots of applications. Lots of people would like to be there. But I am told over and over by our current students, their parents, our alumni, and our faculty that that would not be the UVA experience. Part of the UVA experience is that it is a relatively small residential university. But we already interact with students in other places outside of Charlottesville. We have a Bachelor of Interdisciplinary Science program that we deliver both in person and online in Northern Virginia, in Richmond, in the Tidewater area, and in Charlottesville. We have a program called Produced in Virginia, which is an engineering baccalaureate delivered online to community colleges in Virginia. So we already reach out to other populations. Coursera is a little bit different. Coursera is admittedly an experiment. It's an experiment we're going into because we've got faculty members who want to do it. And because what we hear from the first adopters in Coursera is that it was good for teaching to their residential students, and that it was good for their residential students, and that they're also learning a lot about how students learn. So there's much to be learned from Coursera short of, does this just build you a bigger market? Because, of course, there's no money changing hands in Coursera. So, you know, as a business plan, that's not very promising, right? But there are other reasons for doing Coursera. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so far. But there are other reasons for doing Coursera, I think, besides it's an obvious way to get more students.
But do you see a business plan for UVA with Coursera?
Well, I think that, you know, we haven't offered the first course yet. I think we want to see how that works. But I do think that the advantage that we're looking for in the short run is that it's going to improve what we offer to students on grounds. And for people who study student learning, it's going to give them a great opportunity to learn something new about what students learn in that kind of environment.
One of the ironies of the last few months of UVA was that UVA is in many ways one of the institutions that it may be an overstatement to say that it wouldn't have to change a whit for the next 10 or 20 years and it would still be fine, but it is, it's in a pretty secure place. And yet there are lots of institutions in higher education that are, because of the, some of the forces we've been talking about here, that are pretty vulnerable. And mm-hmm. and so how do you look at sort of higher education broadly, and how, I mean, in terms of UVA, you've got a plan for that, whether we want to define it as incremental or not, is moving ahead. But how do you look at, how vulnerable does the rest of higher education look to you, and how concerned are you about sort of the status of higher education as a whole?
Well, I think that there are a lot of institutions in higher education that have big issues that have got to be addressed. You know, one issue in some states is the underfunded public pension, where there's a big overhang with a lot of faculty coming to retirement, and I don't know how they're going to meet their pension obligations. There are issues of scale. There are many small institutions. Now, you know, again, those are often places that prize the smallness, that see a great value in that. But whether they could achieve some economies of scale in sharing courses, sharing purchasing power, and so on, is probably something that they ought to be investigating. You know, almost surely there are going to be efforts to bring more international students here into the undergraduate. We've always had lots of graduate students who are international, but a lot more interest undergraduate. I know in terms of our own applications, we're seeing a huge surge in international applications for the first-year class, which is different. So I think those are all things that are out there and are likely to affect it.
And then systemically, do you worry about higher education's continued capacity to serve low-income? I mean, because a lot of the pressures we're talking about here are likely to push institutions toward the full-paying students, toward international students. How... And UVA has certainly made its commitment to, through some of the policies it's adopted, to continue to find a place for lower income students there. But systemically, do you have concerns about that, and about whether higher education as a whole is going to continue to serve low income students, especially at elite institutions?
You know, I think it's an issue you always have to be concerned about, and you also have to be concerned that the quality of what you're offering is worthy of the degree that you're conferring. I think that, you know, in at least some situations, the temptation will be more or less to guarantee a piece of paper for attendance as opposed to achievement. And I think that I'm not worried about that at UVA, but I am worried about showing at UVA that our students are learning, and that the residential experience is providing value added over and above what they learn in the classroom. Those are measurement issues. I think it's difficult to demonstrate. I think lots of people believe it to be true. But I think we're all challenged to come up with better metrics for showing that it's true.
You know, a lot of your year has been about, in this discussion, serving students and undergrads, but obviously, UVA plays a very big research role, and I think of one of your colleagues who's also had a busy year down at UT Austin. There is a debate of the value of research, and I wonder, in the Commonwealth and at the federal level, where you feel UVA sits in that debate.
I've heard very little concern about the value of research at UVA. I know that it's a hot issue at some places. You know, much of our research is located either in our medical school or in the disciplines that support medicine. And for what it's worth, I think there's been much less controversy about that kind of research. You know, we had a physicist involved in the discovery of the Higgs boson particle this summer. And, you know, we had a group of students in one of our summer enrichment programs who discovered a new interstellar particle. Yeah, so there's lots of interesting research going on, and I don't hear a whole lot of pushback about that. Even, I say even, because sometimes the humanities are the area most criticized, but at UVA there is a long tradition of excellent humanities research. We're leaders in digital humanities. We teach a lot of languages, many of which are strategic languages, and in the proximity we have to Washington, D.C., strategic languages are appreciated. So I think for a variety of reasons, we've been under less pressure about that. I think our issue is thinking about ways that we can continue to assemble new and interesting research groups and take advantage of maybe different opportunities, particularly if the traditional funding agencies have less money available in the future.